Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Congress avoids the fiscal cliff and braces for the debt ceiling debate. State Republicans call mining legislation their top priority. And a state lawmaker questions the legitimacy of Kwanzaa. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's good to have you with us for our first Week in Review for 2013. We'll have two guests with us from different political viewpoints to talk with you about the top news stories of the week, and you can join in too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Owen Robinson is with us. He is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And John Smart is with us. He is past chair of the Price County Democratic Party, a regular contributor to Fighting Bob and newspapers around Wisconsin, and a member of the board of the United Nations Association of Wisconsin. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Owen.
Good morning.
Happy New Year to you both. You know, I did an interview on New Year's Day on banished words and phrases for 2013. And number one on this list from Lake Superior State University was fiscal cliff. So we're not supposed to say fiscal cliff anymore. However, I'll have to break that ban because the fiscal cliff was indeed in the news this week with Congress passing that deal dealing with taxes to avert the fiscal cliff, but putting off spending decisions and for later on. Let me ask you, Owen, first, what'd you think of that deal?
I didn't think it was a good deal. I mean, there's a couple good things about it, but it's not a good deal. It doesn't address the underlying issues that we continue to have, and I think, as you referenced, we're going to be talking all about this again in a couple months when the debt ceiling debate comes up. So it was probably the best deal the Republicans could have caught because, I mean, the reality is they lost the election, and Obama campaigned on raising taxes on the wealthy, and clearly the public appears to support him in that. So I think I was more disappointed with some of the Republicans in the Senate who voted for the deal because they didn't need to. They could have passed that through the Senate without a single Republican vote. Again, sometimes you gotta play the hand you're dealt, and I think that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of it, John?
Well, I'm not exactly excited about it myself. I think that a lot of Democrats are not really all that thrilled with the way that it turned out either. But it was a compromise, and I think that it was necessary. I know that it was necessary. We had to resolve something in order to get the economy moving again, and I think that that's the way it is. And Owen is right. There are a lot of big fights ahead of us, and I don't know where it's going to go from here. But I do think that the president came up with a very logical and sensible kind of compromise, and that's what government is really all about anyway, isn't it?
Go ahead, Owen.
Well, I'm just going to say, and I think at this point, I mean, it was good that came out of this deal that we've settled the tax rates. We're not going to come into this recurring cycle of needing to extend tax rates every couple years and the big fights that I think has really damaged our political process. So it's good that at this point, and with the repair of the alternative minimum tax and a couple things out of that deal, so at this point, I think we can legitimately say we've pretty much settled on what the revenue stream is going to be for government. Now we need to address the spending because that revenue stream still does not match the level of spending that the federal government is doing.
Yeah, so was this a win for President Obama and the Democrats, Owen?
I think so, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think both from a, you know, he campaigned on raising taxes on higher income earners, and he succeeded in that. He succeeded in not having to give a single dollar in spending compromise on it. And in the process, I think Delta really fractured a good chunk of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. So I think we see a clear split in the party now. And politically speaking, that the Republicans have kind of abandoned their brand as the no tax increase party.
Does that make you smile, John?
Only temporarily. I'm afraid that a great deal more is coming, and I think that Owen is right in pointing out the fact that the debt ceiling is going to make a lot of difference, and I think we have to wait for that.
Yeah, Republicans say they will press their demand that spending be reduced dramatically in exchange for allowing any more U.S. borrowing as we approach this debt ceiling debate. President Obama and Democrats insist that their goal of raising the $16.4 trillion federal debt ceiling is non-negotiable. Owen, are you hopeful that serious spending cuts are going to be achieved?
No, I'm not hopeful. And I think that here you clearly see where I think now President Obama and the Democrats are unfettered by needing to run for re-election, and this is what he wants. He wants a large expansion of government, more spending, and he wants to raise the debt ceiling to pay for it. And at the same time, although he's given some platitudes about needing to control spending and control debt, he's offered no serious proposals to do so. So until something real comes up, you know, again, with the Republicans only controlling one-third of the legislative, you know, apparatus, I have very, very small hope.
What do you anticipate, John?
I really don't think that that's likely to be the case. For one thing, I think people are pointing at this in the wrong direction. The president's asking for the debt ceiling to be raised has more to do with what Congress has already passed. The president is not anticipating a debt ceiling increase. He's simply trying to bring a debt ceiling increase into line with what Congress has already appropriated. And I think that people misunderstand that. They make it sound like it's some kind of an open ticket for the president to spend money willy-nilly as he chooses, and it's not the case at all. The way that this law works is that the president is asking for an increase in the spending limit in order to borrow more money to pay the bills. The bills that have already been paid for are acknowledged and approved by the Congress. So I think that we are overspending our limits. I agree, but I don't think this is the way to approach it.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with John Smart and Owen Robinson. This is our Week in Review for January 4th, 2013. It's the first Week in Review of the year. We are going to be talking about the top state, national, and international stories in the news this week, and we welcome your views and the issues that you want to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You know, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was not happy at all with Congress this week. Let's take a listen.
Politics was placed before our oaths to serve our citizens. For me, it was disappointing and disgusting to watch.
He was very upset that Congress did not vote on a bill that would have provided aid to victims of Hurricane Sandy. And he really laid into Congress and was very upset with Speaker John Boehner for not even answering his calls. Owen, what do you make of this?
I think that Christie's comment has far more to do with Christie trying to up his national stature for his future presidential ambitions than it does with anything real. I mean, the reality is he's going to get his gigantic pork-laden bill 3, 4, 5 days later than he otherwise would have. So it's much ado about nothing.
Ah, what do you make of it, John?
Well, I think that it's kind of the beginning of a schism in the Republican Party, and I welcome it because I think the Republican Party has been skating too close to the right wing, and I think that it's time to bring people back into it. I think that the Republican Party of today would not even welcome people like, say, Dwight Eisenhower or Bob Taft or any number of other important Republicans of the past. In fact, even St. Ronald Reagan probably wouldn't be allowed in the party these days, and I think it's necessary for the party to be brought back to earth. And I'm in favor of the two-party system, but that requires that the parties represent a large portion of the American public. And I think that the Republican Party, as it is currently constructed, really doesn't do that anymore. And I would look forward to the fact that it becomes a more universal party.
Yeah. Do you see this, John, in any way as a weakening the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party?
Oh, I think so, yeah. The Tea Party, I think, had its big shot in 2010, and I think it's been kind of coasting and slowly subsiding ever since.
What about you, Owen?
Well, I think the fact that the Republican Party does have Governor Christie and Boehner and Paul Ryan shows quite a bit of a breadth of the people that the party accepts. And whereas, you know, it's fun to speculate about whether the Republican Party would accept a Eisenhower or people in the past, I don't think that the current Democratic Party, as currently constructed, would accept Kennedy or LBJ. So, I mean, lots of things have changed over the years.
And why did you say this bill to help Hurricane Sandy victims is a pork-laden bill?
Well, it is. If you look at what's in it there or what's being proposed, there's all sorts of money that goes to normal pet projects and political insiders. And we saw a lot of pork, frankly, in the fiscal cliff deal, if I can say fiscal cliff, as well, because it very little passes through Congress without having some pork laden into it.
Yeah. Any thoughts on whether this bill was really going to be helping victims of Hurricane Sandy, John, or whether it was pork laden?
Every bill that comes through Congress is pork laden to a certain degree, but I think this bill was intended to help people who were deeply affected by Hurricane Sandy or whatever you want to call it. And I think that the fact that the government has always been there in the past in order to do that, and it was so clear to so many people, Republicans and Democrats alike, that this was a purely political move to withhold funding especially New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, was really just crooked and crazy. And I think that the Republicans are going to suffer for that because the public perception is such that it looks like they are being abandoned.
Was this payback in any way, Owen, for Chris Christie's praise of President Obama just before the election?
I don't think so much for that. I do think that there were politics involved, and I think Boehner was trying to send a message to Governor Christie after his blustery attitude in the past few weeks and demanding things of Congress and whatnot and criticizing national Republicans. So, Christie is not known for his warm, fuzzy personality, and he doesn't make a lot of friends that way.
Yeah. Well, there were rumors that John Boehner was going to step down as Speaker of the House of Representatives, and he did win another term easily, though he did have some Republicans vote against him. But John Boehner won another term as House Speaker as the 113th Congress begins. Boehner was criticized by some of his fellow Republicans for his handling of the fiscal cliff and for delaying the vote on the Superstorm Sandy storm aid. What's your opinion of Boehner? Is he doing a good job with the House?
I think he's doing an adequate job. I think clearly there are many issues with which I disagree with him. I think that the rumors about him either stepping down from the speakership or losing were greatly exaggerated. And I think that's, you know, probably some wishful thinking on the part of some in the Republican Party as well as many Democrats. But looking at the way Congress actually works and the fact that there wasn't any real challenger in the House that stood up to challenge him. And I think that was an indication that he was going to coast back into the Speaker's chair.
Anything to say on this, John?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people looked at it and said the only alternative to Speaker Boehner was a Speaker Cantor. And that, I think, sent chills through the hearts of many people, both Republicans and Democrats. And I think that accounted for the fact that Speaker Boehner won his re-election.
Meanwhile, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, and just remembering how a body like the House of Representatives works, where, you know, over the years, Boehner's done a lot of favors for politicians and campaigned for them and put them in chairmanships and all these things. And you know, that Speaker election is when a lot of those favors get called in.
We are talking with Owen Robinson, who is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News and blogger at bootsandsabers.com, and John Smart, who is past chair of the Price County Democratic Party and a regular contributor to Fighting Bob in newspapers around Wisconsin. We are reviewing the news of the week, from the fiscal cliff to the debt ceiling upcoming debate, to we'll get into some other issues involving the new Congress. And we will welcome your input at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you will stay tuned to the Ideas Network, and I hope you will join in after 4 this afternoon. It's your views on the news during At Issue with Ben Marins. You can call in to talk about the story that mattered most to you this week during your views on the news every Friday after 4. Every Friday at this time, we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the top state and national news stories of the week. And today we have with us Owen Robinson and John Smart. We do have an open line for you if you want to comment on the news of the week or if there is an issue in the news this week that you would like to bring up, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have a caller who's been waiting. Mike in Hurley is with us. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Joy.
Morning.
I had a quick question. We had the big debate about our debt ceiling is going to be coming up, and raising taxes on the wealthy to try to make a couple of extra $30, $40 billion in savings. But nobody talks about the Federal Reserve spending, which I thought was 45, but the news had $85 billion a month, which is almost $1 trillion a year is being spent buying bonds. And who signed that, who authorized it, and how does that work into our budget?
Well, I don't know if we are prepared to go into that full issue, but do you have any thoughts on that, Owen?
I think the Federal Reserve has been an uncontrollable body for some time, and it has a dramatic impact on our economy and on government spending that I think very few people fully understand. And frankly, we haven't had a budget in 4 years now, so I don't think anything fits into a budget at this point.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on this, John?
I just think that the Federal Reserve is probably a subject for an entire hour at least,
right,
of discussion, and I don't know if we can get into it here.
Well, I mentioned that the new 113th Congress, all the members took their oaths yesterday, and there were committee assignments that were announced. We have Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson named to Senate committees dealing with the budget, foreign relations, and small business. He says he's pleased with his assignments because they will help him focus on reining in the overreach of the federal government. And Senator Tammy Baldwin will also be our newest senator for the state of Wisconsin, will be joining Johnson on the Senate Budget Committee and the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. Let me start with John this time. How influential are you hoping our new Senator Tammy Baldwin will be?
I suspect that Tammy Baldwin is going to be a very influential senator. She has already kind of formed an alliance with Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, and I think that the two of them are going to make waves, serious waves. But as long as we're talking about committee assignments, when you mentioned that Ron Johnson was appointed to the Federal Foreign Affairs Committee, all I could think about was that he replaced Russ Feingold, and Russ Feingold was on the Foreign Affairs Committee and was chairman of the subcommittee on Africa and did an extraordinary amount of work on that regard, and made a lot of people aware in the Congress and otherwise of the situations in the continent of Africa, and it's very much missed. I can't see that we're going to have the same kind of coverage and the same kind of intelligent approach as we did under Russ Feingold, but that's the way things go, and I don't think that I can say anything more about that.
Yeah. Well, how about, Owen, your thoughts on Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson?
Well, I must say I have been impressed with how quickly Ron Johnson's influence has risen in the Senate. I think he's certainly making a name for himself as one of the fiscal hawks, and I hope that his efforts come to fruition at some point. As far as Senator Baldwin goes, I mean, looking at history as a guide, she was pretty much a non-factor in the House, and I would like to say that all of Wisconsin senators can be influential and have an effect on the country. I guess we'll wait and see.
Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was discharged from the hospital this week after being treated for a blood clot in her head. The State Department says she remains committed to testifying about Benghazi, though it's not clear when that's going to be. That story triggered this thought from Dave in Wanakee, who called in to say, before her diagnosis, Hillary Clinton was accused of faking illness as a way to avoid testifying on Benghazi. I would like the guests to comment on what the Republicans would say to Hillary Clinton today. All right. Well, Owen, the Benghazi flu sounds, she had a concussion and a blood clot in her head. What do you make of that?
Well, I think at this point we all wish the Secretary of State to get better, and I hope that her health recovers and she comes back. I do think that it's difficult in a situation given the timing and the fact that there was so little information coming from the Secretary of State's office that those accusations get made. And frankly, they're not uncommon in diplomatic parlance to get sick at convenient times. And even now, as you mentioned, she says she's going to come and testify on Benghazi, but nothing's been scheduled, nothing's been brought up, and her term is coming quickly to a close. So it will be interesting to see if that actually happens.
John?
Yeah, I've got a whole lot to say on this subject. For one thing, anybody who knows anything about Hillary Clinton knows that she's so feisty that the idea of faking an illness in order to not appear before a Senate committee is absolutely nuts. She would be there no matter what if it were possible. And I think that we are all thankful that she seems to be recovering from this situation. And I certainly hope so, because I'm anticipating her running for president in 4 years. And I have a personal experience with her. Do you want me to go into that, Joy? You've heard the story.
Go ahead.
When I was in the Peace Corps, which happened in 1996, I was in the Peace Corps in Uzbekistan in Central Asia, and I got a message from the ambassador, the United States ambassador to Uzbekistan, saying that Hillary Clinton, who was then the First Lady of the United States, was going to be making a state visit. And did I want her to come to Bukhara, the city where I was stationed? And I said, yes, of course I did. And we arranged for her to visit my school where I was teaching. And she was supposed to be there for 30 minutes, and she spent an hour and a half. And she was just absolutely terrific. I was so proud of her, and I was so proud of my students for being so good at responding to her. And this feisty lady that I met and have enormous regard for, the things that they've been saying about her in recent days are just crazy. She has been the most traveled Secretary of State in the history of the United States. She has been a remarkable international diplomat. She has dealt with issues all over the world. And the idea that these people, certain people, would be, you know, commenting on her that she got the Benghazi flu or something or other. And the whole thing about Benghazi is another whole story, because it was the Republicans in the House of Representatives, mostly Daryl Issa, who cut the funding for security for international missions and embassies that allowed such a thing to even happen in the first place.
Yeah.
And again, I could go on for a
right.
long time.
Right, we don't want to necessarily go back there. But Owen, do conservative commentators who were saying or hinting that she was faking it owe Hillary Clinton an apology?
Perhaps, but we also must remember that even before she had her concussion and got ill, that she was already stalling in Congress and refusing to testify. When she was scheduled to testify but ended up in New Zealand or Australia or wherever she was and couldn't make it. So her avoiding the Benghazi issue happened well before she got ill. And so I think again, with very little explanation coming out of the Secretary of State, for people to think such things was certainly rational. Given the hindsight, I certainly probably do owe her an apology.
Yeah. Speaking of apologies, this is a different issue, but it reminded me that this week, State Senator Glenn Grothman made some rather controversial comments about the holiday Kwanzaa, saying that no African Americans even celebrated this, and that this was just some sort of a liberal-backed holiday that really wasn't a holiday, and made some remarks about the founder of this holiday. People have asked him if he was would apologize for what they considered bigoted remarks, and he said no. John Smart, do you think Glenn Grothman should apologize for those comments?
I think Glenn Grossman is an embarrassment to the state of Wisconsin, frankly. And this is not the first time, and it will not be the last, I suspect, that we will have to be ashamed of the things that that man has said. Kwanzaa holiday, I've been following it for many, many years, and I know it is how it was originated, and I know how it is being treated by the African-American population of the United States. And for him to make those kinds of comments is just obscene.
Owen?
And I think clearly Senator Grossman has an opinion on Kwanzaa, whether you agree with it or not. I think it's always telling, I would say, that the immediate response is to call him a bigot or to call him racist, when if you read his statement, he's clearly criticizing the holiday and how it's being treated in our culture and our schools. And in fact, in our local West Bend Daily News today, we find out that indeed Kwanzaa is being taught as part of the holiday season with Christmas and Hanukkah within the public schools. So I think for him to have those concerns are certainly rational. Whether or not you agree with them is an entire question, but it's something we can debate. But I think really looking at, you know, after we've had this discussion about the fiscal cliff and spending and state spending, and we have all these other proposals that are coming up, this is, I mean, it's an interesting distraction. It's like seeing a platypus on the floor of the Senate or something, but it really means nothing in the grand scheme of things. You know, there's a white state senator from Wisconsin who doesn't like Kwanzaa. Who cares?
Well, we will talk about some other state issues in just a bit. We are reviewing the news of the week. I'm Joy Cardine with John Smart and Owen Robinson, and we welcome your input, too. We'll talk next about Governor Walker saying that he wants mining legislation to be job one of the new legislature. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Governor Walker says he's open to tweaking last year's failed mining bill as long as the new bill leads to an actual mining company doing business in Wisconsin. Governor Walker said this week that any changes to the bill that passed the state assembly last year would have to lead to the creation of jobs. Meanwhile, Republicans say mining is priority number one for the upcoming legislative session that will begin on Monday. Let me start first with John Smart, since you're closest to that proposed mine in northern Wisconsin. What do you make of mining being job one in the legislature next session?
Like a lot of people who live up here in the Northwoods, I'm very concerned about it. I'm concerned about the fact that what they're trying to do is they're trying to create regulations, if indeed any regulations at all, but they're trying to create some regulations that would essentially allow the mining companies free rein to do whatever they pleased. And we are very concerned about our environment. There are very few places in the United States that are allowed, that are left like northern Wisconsin is, as basically second growth forest, pretty much undisturbed. And we would like to maybe be able to keep a lot of it that way. And there's a lot of complaint coming from the members of the Native American tribes up here who are concerned about it and concerned about the possible degradation of their water supply, which is something that we all have to take into consideration. And it just scares us that they're trying to rush this through without an awful lot of really good study on it. It's interesting to compare what the regulations are in Wisconsin with regulations in Michigan and Minnesota, our neighboring states, because Michigan and Minnesota have both cut back. There's a major study that was done in Minnesota about mesothelioma occurrences in areas of open pit iron mining. And I think that it's something that we have to take into consideration, too. And I think Michigan has been doing much of the same kind of thing. And what these companies are trying to do, it seems to us, is they're trying to ram through legislation that will allow them to go ahead and skip the kinds of careful considerations that are taken in Michigan and Minnesota. And I think that that's something we have to be very careful about. I'm worried. I'm very worried. Most of the people up here in the Northwoods are about what might happen with our lands and our environment.
Yeah. Should they be worried, Owen?
Well, I think that we discussed this a few weeks ago, but that's where I find it interesting to hear terms like ramming through a bill and whatnot, because we've been talking about mining legislation now for quite some time, and it went through one legislative cycle and failed. It will go through another legislative cycle where we'll have lengthy debates about what should be in it or what should not be in it. But at some point, there has to be a compromise between doing nothing and giving the mining companies full rein. And surely there's a way to come to a compromise to protect the environmental concerns that are certainly legitimate, at the same time not using those concerns as a means just to torpedo the entire process. So, you know, and we're in that interesting phase right now where the legislature isn't in session yet, so we have all these ideas being floated in trial balloons, and even with Walker's statement about the mining bill, he's not specific about what changes he may or may not support in such a bill, and we see that with lots of comments happening on various issues in these weeks, and this is a time where we kind of have these ideas, but until we see real legislation on the table and it goes through that real process and goes through the committee hearings and the public hearings and all the stuff that it's going to go through, we don't really have a good idea of what we're talking about yet.
Owen Robinson is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News, blogger at bootsandsabers.com. And John Smart is past chair of the Price County Democratic Party, a regular contributor to Fighting Bob in newspapers around Wisconsin. John Smart, also a member of the board of the United Nations Association of Wisconsin, our two guests today for this, the first week in review of 2013. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's time now for our Week in Review quiz. During our 6 o'clock hour this morning, we talked with Jackie Johnson, who's the founder of mispronouncer.com, about a new online map that she worked on with the state cartographer's office that verbally pronounces Wisconsin's cities, towns, and other geographical locations for you. She says the hardest-to-say place on the map lies on the Menominee-Shawnee County border and means Middle Village. In our Week in Review quiz question today, we need you to call in and give us the native translation, the native name for Middle Village. If you're even remotely close, we will consider it correct and you'll be eligible to win. We will randomly select one correct answer in person, and that person will be entitled to one of the books we featured on the program recently. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Call in if you know how to say the native name for Middle Village in the state of Wisconsin. It's a town on the Menominee-Shawnee County line. All right, this is the Week in Review. I'm talking with Owen Robinson and John Smart today, reviewing the news of the week. Also this week in the state of Wisconsin, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says the Republicans are planning to push for a reduction in the state income tax. He says he backs a cut that would affect individuals and families making between $20,000 and $200,000 a year, and that the state's tax code is too complicated with too many tax credits. All right, well, John Smart, first, do you agree with Robin Voss's lower and simplified tax approach?
I don't think I would agree with Robin Voss on much of anything, as long as we get to that point. However, I do understand the idea that tax codes as such, whether it be state or federal, are far too complicated for anybody's understanding. Various little details have been tucked into these laws over the years that make it almost impossible for anybody to really understand what's going on, and also make it entirely possible for very wealthy people to protect their income without having to pay taxes accordingly. And I think it's time that something is done about that. I don't think that's what Representative Voss has in mind. I think that what he has in mind is to make it easier for rich people, and I don't ascribe to that particular angle. But I think that something needs to be done to make tax law in general more sensible and more understandable.
Owen?
And I agree with all of that. I think what's not clear to me from Voss's statements are whether or not he intends an income tax decrease to be revenue neutral and offset with a simplification of the tax code, which would presumably leave fewer loopholes and fewer ways for people to not pay those taxes. So, kind of going back to our earlier comments of whether or not we actually see the legislation, whether we're talking an actual decrease in taxes or if we're just talking revising the tax code to make it easier and simpler with a lower rate, both, I think, are good ideas and things to work through.
Earlier this week, we also talked with the Wisconsin Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Mark Gottlieb, and he was telling us about a citizens panel's recommendations on ways to fund transportation in Wisconsin over the next 10 years. Among those recommendations, raise the gas tax by a nickel a gallon. It also was recommending a mileage-based registration fee increase. But when it comes to the gas tax, Governor Walker this week told Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson that there is no appetite for a gas tax increase to help pay for money for roads. So, Owen, no gas tax increase for roads?
I wouldn't anticipate seeing one. I do think that transportation is an area that needs quite a bit of attention in Wisconsin. It's a huge thing. It's important to our infrastructure. It's also a department that continues to be riddled with issues and overspending and ridiculous things, honestly, that Governor Walker has not yet addressed. And I hope that he and Secretary Gottlieb take a serious look at how that department actually spends money before they start asking for more.
Really? All right. So do you think you would be supporting no increase in the gas tax then, Owen?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, John, what about that?
Well, I think that it's interesting to note that we have about the lowest gas tax of any industrialized nation in the earth, for that matter. And we also have about the cheapest fuel. And we need to rethink the whole situation. It's been very carefully proven that it's the cheapest way to move large numbers of people and freight is by rail, for instance. But this governor scrapped, before he even took office, he scrapped the idea of a rail link that would cross Wisconsin and connecting Chicago and the Twin Cities. And I don't think that he really understands the total long-term solutions that are necessary for this particular problem, and I think that we need to do that. As far as whether or not we should tax gasoline by the gallon, yes, I think we should, and I think that we should tax anything that has to do with it, because we need to get back to a more sensible approach to transportation, and this is not the way to do it.
Yeah, and the governor said there's no appetite for the gas tax or a sales tax increase to fund transportation projects in Wisconsin, but he told Sean Johnson that he wouldn't rule out finding new money for transportation somehow. The story doesn't make it clear how that somehow is. Owen Robinson, would you think that this mileage-based registration fee would be a good idea?
No, I wouldn't. But at the same time, I do think that as we look at the funding mechanisms for our transportation department, I agree with John to the extent that the users of the system, which honestly is pretty much all of us, should be paying for it. Whether or not that a tax on gasoline is in the age of increasing mileage and people driving fewer miles out there is, I don't know if that's the most rational way to do it or if it's a direct tax or some other way. So I think those are things we continue to evaluate as our transportation technology changes. At the same time, I don't think that there's any appetite in the public for a mileage tax and how you would actually implement that and how it would actually, how we'd have to, I don't know, register our mileage every year. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I think it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you think that particular recommendation has any merit, John?
No, I think that would be impossible to try to maintain. But I do think that we have to, again, look at it from a broader picture. And I think that approaching people from the amount of miles they drive and all that kind of thing, the way that we can control that is by controlling the price of fuel. And if we make fuel expensive enough, people will think more in terms of buying vehicles that are more economical. And that's the direction we have to go. But again, I would like to emphasize that there's an awful lot that could be and should be done with mass transportation that is not being done, especially in the state of Wisconsin, but throughout the United States. And I think that it's a direction that we really must think in terms of going.
Let me take a call. Kevin in Deerfield. Hello, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you. On the issue of income tax reduction, and at the same time that we've had reduced school aids in the state and revenue limits on local governments, my property taxes the last 2 years have gone up significantly. My income has gone down, and so I'm really concerned about transferring or, you know, reducing income tax revenue to the state and what that's going to do to property taxes. I do know that our local school district in Deerfield this year had a state aid increase over last year, and I'm trying to figure that out, but I still think that with the big reduction from the previous year that, you know, that's causing part of the problem with property taxes.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Maybe, John, I know you care deeply about school funding issues, and maybe you can address this first.
I would first of all say that I can't believe that his property taxes for school funding have gone down, because that's not the case in most jurisdictions. And we really need to think more in terms of a better way to fund our schools, and that's a long-term project, something that I've been working on for a long time. And I live in a district in northern Wisconsin, for instance, where much of the property is owned by the state, federal, and county governments, and so is non-taxable, and which means that tax rates on properties, such as they are, tend to go up in order to cover the expenses, which is really impossible.
Yeah, and I think he was concerned that if his income taxes went down, his property taxes would just go up.
Well, he's trying to balance income tax with property tax, and they're actually separate, totally separate things. Income tax goes directly to the state. Property taxes go to school boards and other local areas. So I think that's a little confusing. But I understand is his point, mm-hmm. You know, and the idea that taxes, whatever they are, continue to go up. Of course they do.
Owen, do you want to address this at all?
Well, and I think where Kevin was trying to get to, Larry, is if there's a decrease in state income tax, that's less money to be doled back out in the form of shared revenue and mm-hmm. other local tax supports. But again, I don't think it's clear from the proposal that, or from even the discussion of a proposal, that income revenue or income tax revenue would actually decrease. It depends on how it's done and what the other reforms that would take place as part of that tax. And something we've seen over history is, generally speaking, when you decrease those tax rates, you get increased revenue just because people make more. So it's without knowing the details of the proposal, it's I think impossible at this point to see if there would be any effect on property taxes or not.
Yeah, this week a filing deadline for those wanting to run in the spring elections, and we now know who's going to be on the ballot for state Supreme Court a race this spring, and there's also going to be a primary office, I guess, on February the 19th. The incumbent justice, Pat Rogensack, faces now a challenge from either Marquette University Law School professor Ed Falone or Milwaukee attorney Vince Megna. Those two challengers will meet on February 19th, and of course the winner will go on to face Rogensack. Your thoughts, Owen, in general on the upcoming Supreme Court race?
I must say, I was a little surprised to see fewer people get into the race to challenge Rogensack. Or rather, as I look at the two candidates, Falone, who I've debated on this program in the past and who's a perfectly nice gentleman, I'm not sure that being a professor at Marquette qualifies you to be a Supreme Court justice. And Megna is just a liberal bomb thrower. So I don't see either of these as real serious challengers, frankly, to Rogensack. And given our history of Supreme Court races in the past few years, I'm a little surprised by that. But then again, once we get into the heat of the political season, who knows what's going to be thrown against the wall.
And I misspoke. I'm thinking partisan when it's a nonpartisan race. This all three of these candidates running for state Supreme Court would be on the February 19th primary ballot. John Smart, your thoughts?
I understand what was being said. However, I think that it's time to change the course of the Supreme Court, and I think that Justice Rogan Sack needs to be replaced. And at this point, I'm favoring Professor Fallone simply because I know his background and I know where he comes from and I know what his judicial philosophy would be. And there's no reason to assume that a college professor in a law school would be less qualified than anybody else to succeed to this court.
Very briefly, Owen.
I was going to say what's interesting is that while John thinks Rogan's Act needs to be replaced, I've heard nobody actually go through her record and criticize it other than they disagree with some of the votes she made. But she appears to have been a very competent justice for a decade, and I don't know why we would replace her.
All right. Let's move on to another spring election, that for State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Republican State Representative Don Pridemore. And is challenging incumbent Tony Evers. That election will take place on April 2nd. John Smart, I'd like first off, I take it you're probably backing Tony Evers in this race?
Absolutely. I know Dr. Evers. I've worked with him in the past, and I have enormous regard and respect for him. And I think that he's been fighting a very powerful battle for the public schools in Wisconsin. And as far as Representative Pridemore is concerned, his credentials have to do with the fact that he's being supported by the NRA, he's being supported by various right-wing organizations, and I don't think that we need to politicize the Office of State Superintendent of Schools. It's a constitutional office. It was very carefully put into the Constitution by the founders of the state of Wisconsin, and I think it's a very important office. And Tony Evers has been doing a spectacular job against all odds, and I would like to have him continue in that position.
Your analysis of this race, Owen?
Well, I think you have Representative Pridemore is certainly a staunch conservative in the legislature, and that's its qualifications about whether it would bring in a different perspective on how we work with education in the state. And he has some experience on some legislative committees, but clearly no strong background in education policy in general. Up against an incumbent Evers who is more of an education technocrat, if anything else. And I don't see that as much of a challenge. I think Evers probably sails to victory.
I wanted to talk to you briefly both about this issue, Owen, that you're upset about, I see on your blog. The governor and the attorney general would like to expand DNA collection in Wisconsin, and you don't think that's a good idea?
No, I don't. And currently we have a DNA data bank for felons. So if you're a convicted felon, we keep your DNA on file. That is what it is. What the attorney general and the governor want to do is expand that to everybody who's arrested, even on misdemeanor charges, where they would collect your DNA and store that in a state data bank. I think that has severe civil liberties issues as far as DNA is not just an identifier. It's your entire genetic code. It can tell you your propensity for different kinds of diseases and syndromes and how old you may be and all kinds of things that we continue to discover about it. And taking that kind of information about an individual and placing it in a state data bank when they've done nothing, when they haven't been convicted of anything, when they've just been arrested for something, I think is a severe blow to civil liberties. And I hope Governor Walker and J.B. Van Hollen back off of this.
I'm guessing, John Smart, you might be on the same page with Owen on this one.
You guessed right. I don't like the idea of government taking that much interest in specific information about citizens. I just don't like it.
All right. Well, let's.
And I agree with Owen on this one.
Let me announce that Dee in Madison is the winner of our Week in Review quiz. She answered correctly that the town on the Menominee-Shawnee County line, which means Middle Village, is pronounced this way. I'm not going to say it, but we'll have Jackie mispronounce or say it. Hold on.
Nanawia Ominahican. Nanawia Ominahican.
There we go. That is a census-designated place that has no legal status as an incorporated municipality. 281 people live there, according to the 2010 census. And again, that's what Jackie Mispronouncer says is the most difficult name in Wisconsin to pronounce.
scared you off, huh?
I'll have to practice. I'll have to practice. I've got a lot of them down. Do you have a town that you hear mangled all the time, John or Owen, in Wisconsin? Like Shawano?
I live in the Shawamigan area, so I understand that one very well.
I figured so. Yeah, the Shawamigan National Forest. Well, we'll leave it there. I hope you both have a great weekend. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Owen.
John Smart and Owen Robinson. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.